What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. I'm telling you now, if I hear anything, I swear on our mother, I'm going to kill somebody. I'm going to kill somebody, Adam.
Well, go ahead and kill everybody. You're the tough guy. Go kill people.
Kill Vicky. Kill Salvi. Kill Tommy Como. Kill me while you're at it. What do I care? You're killing yourself the way you eat. You're a fat f***. Look at you.
Yeah, I'm fat all right. It's called Give Me an Oscar Fat.
This week on Film Spotting, we'll share our top five actor transformations. Many, it's true, like Robert De Niro's Jake LaMotta, that earned the actor's attention at awards time.
Hit me, Adam.
I think you might want to drop the method stuff before we actually start the show here, Josh. The new film Dallas Buyers Club features pretty significant transformations from actors Matthew McConaughey and Jared Leto. Our review and more.
Seriously, hit me, Adam.
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level.
For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM1113.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Josh and I will be unrecognizable by the time we get to this week's top five actor transformations.
My voice is going to be at least 50 pounds heavier.
That's later in the show.
But first, let's see how Matthew McConaughey does almost 50 pounds lighter in Dallas Buyers Club.
Mr. Woodruff, you've tested positive for HIV. Have you ever used intravenous drugs? Have you ever engaged in homosexual conduct?
Homo. You say homo? You made a mistake. That ain't me.
Mr. Woodruff, we estimate you have 30 days left.
Newsflash, y'all. Ain't nothing out there can kill Ron Woodruff in 30 days.
Them drugs.
They just released for testing, and I know this hospital's one of the sites and need
it. It doesn't work that way, Mr. Woodruff.
Where are you going?
They got good meds out of Mexico that's better than what you can get here in the States.
This is protein, totally non-toxic.
And you can't buy this in the USA?
Not approved.
You could be making a fortune off of this.
You look great.
Actually, I look amazing.
Anything to declare?
Nada.
They're importing illegal drugs for sale. It's a very serious offense.
They're not illegal. They're merely unapproved.
Dallas Buyers Club has two things going for it before the lights even go down in the theater. A fascinating, based-on-fact source story and a deeply sympathetic cause. Matthew McConaughey stars as Ron Woodruff, an electrician and Texas rodeo huckster who is diagnosed with AIDS in 1985 during the first wave of the crisis. He's given 30 days to live and also denied access to experimental drugs by the medical establishment. So his response is to build up this international underground market for supplements, for vitamins, and some harder substances, too, that are not approved by the Federal Drug Administration. The business is a success, which means that the decidedly homophobic Woodruff must contend with the fact that many of his customers are gay men. So Dallas Buyers Club has many things going on here. It's a health story, given Woodruff's own struggle with the disease. It's a fight-the-power drama in that he takes on both this hospital here in Dallas and the Federal Drug Administration. And it's a personal growth story as Woodruff grapples with his homophobia. This would be a tall order for any filmmaking team. And we have here McConaughey, of course, also screenwriters Craig Borton and Melissa Wallach. And the director is Jean-Marc Vallée, a Canadian filmmaker. I wonder if Dallas Buyers Club can handle all these elements. In our Korean auteurs marathon recently, Adam, we talked about The Chaser, which was at once a very dark comedy, a serial killer thriller, and this personal tragedy story woven into it. And we both felt that it handled all of those elements pretty well. So to get back to Dallas Buyers Club, maybe I can give us a more focused structural question to get the conversation started here. Who is the antagonist in this movie? Is it the disease? Is it the medical establishment? Is it Woodruff's own prejudice? And if you answer that all of these things are in different ways, do you think Dallas Buyers Club is able to weave them into a cohesive, compelling narrative?
Well, first of all, I do love comparing this movie to The Chaser. I get where you're going completely, but there really couldn't be two more.
Didn't come immediately to mind while
films.
You were watching Dallas Buyers Club?
I didn't think about that serial killer movie. I think your assessment of the varying antagonist is probably pretty accurate. And in terms of answering your question, does it do any of those things really well? Probably not willing to say that, Josh. Does it do them all well enough? Yeah, I think I would say that. I think all of those narrative threads, as you suggested, are inherently dramatic, so it really comes down to execution. And with some minor exceptions, and I'm sure we're going to get into a few of them, I don't think it overplays its hand with any of them. I think it's interesting, for example, that you even use the phrase grapples with his homophobia, and you talk about how, as he is dealing with some of his clients, he has to contend with that homophobia. I really didn't see that at all. I don't think we get a sense of him truly grappling with anything, not in the way that that line suggests anyway. I don't think it's a bad thing. I actually think it's a good thing. I think we just see a character who's a smart businessman, who's motivated in his pursuits, and he befriends a character in Rayon, who is played by Jared Leto, who's a transgender character who is also suffering from AIDS. He befriends him more out of just needing a business partner and the fact that he's able to bring him some new business and some very high-paying clients. So by the end of the film, does he become less outwardly homophobic? Yes, of course he does, but there isn't, for me, or I don't recall any true signpost moments that we have to deal with that really scream that out to you. It evolves, you see him evolve, you see how his perspective shifts, but it doesn't really draw too much attention to it. There certainly aren't any big speeches. Even the big scene that I'm sure you're about to hit me with that takes place at a grocery store where he meets one of his old friends who he thought was one of his best buddies and then turns on him once he finds out that he has AIDS and accuses him of being a homosexual, which is a terrible accusation to Ron at this time. Even that scene is one where he's motivated not by his desire to really help his friend Rayon so much. I think that's probably there, or to show how sophisticated and cultured he is now that he has no problem at all with gay people or transgender people. It's really much more about Ron's desire to make his so-called friend eat it, to really shove it in his face and shove back on that friend how he treated him. So I think that scene actually works.
That's a very generous reading of that scene.
It's all over it. You know he wanted nothing more than to get back at that guy, and it works.
He wanted to show that, well, let me put it this way. The movie wanted to show where he had come. And this is one of my problems with the films, is it doesn't show it by any natural, careful development. It gives us exactly, you gave me the phrase, signpost moments. And that grocery store scene is possibly one of the biggest ones.
But is it really
where
a
this
bad
friend,
scene, Josh? Is it a bad scene?
It's so bad because
I didn't feel that
there
way.
Is no build to the point where Ron, who previously wouldn't have been caught dead anywhere in his social life with any of these other people he has now met, is suddenly shopping with Rayon, and then they have to elevate it to that next level. He's going to run into, oh, who is it? His former best friend. I mean, there are so many coincidences in this movie that I have trouble with, too. But of course, it's going to be the best friend. And of course, it's going to escalate even to this violent fight. I mean, this movie has, I'll give you another signpost moment that I had trouble with. It's not as big as that one, but it's another example of how the movie handles these. It's when he first goes to a support group for AIDS sufferers, and he's going to research himself. And I really like how this scene begins. There's a guy standing outside of the door, and he opens the door for Ron, okay? A very unmanly thing to do in this culture. And right away, Woodruff reads that as gay, okay? Mm-hmm. If he's going to open the door for me, he must be gay. I don't want anything to do with him. And he just gives this slight kind of shaking of his head to the guy and proceeds in. Really well done. Perfect touch that captures Ron's attitude and how it's going to display when he's encountering someone else. But what does this movie do? He steps in the door. We get the same exact thing, except done more heightened and more poorly, where a flamboyantly effeminate guy comes up to him at the table in the back and puts his arm around him and starts talking to him in his face. And Ron rebuffs him in a very dramatic way. And this is just an example of how the movie hits the same beat twice, the second time much worse than the previous time. And I found that it wasn't even with that thread, with the thread of these other people that he encounters, he had no idea. He didn't even like consider that gay men existed, let alone he's going to be working alongside them. That's one thread that the movie hammers home. But everything it does is this obvious, whether it's the hospital scenes with a really bad Jennifer Garner and how they're playing the tension between her and her boss and the research going on there. Overall, I saw where every scene in this movie was going about 3 seconds in, and then I had to sit back and watch it proceed for the next 3 or 4 minutes in a way that was completely uninteresting or unsurprising. It was a real disappointment for me.
Arigato.
What are you doing here?
Well, I live here.
Where's Rayon? Your roommates?
Not exactly. What are you doing here?
Roger Thompson. This is my patient. You treating these people?
Oh, they're treating themselves.
With what?
Vitamins, peptide T, DDC, anything but that poison you're hawking.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film starring Matthew McConaughey, Dallas Buyers Club. I'd agree with you, Josh, that there aren't any major surprises. And in films that I have a really strong response to, in films that I can say I love or think are great, I have many surprises. I didn't have those here. But did any of those scenes, even as they played out the way I sort of expected them to, did they let me down? Did they annoy me? No, they didn't. And I think actually you're wrong in your assessment of that scene when you say that when he walks into that support group, it doesn't hit the same beat twice. It does exactly what you say it did, which is heighten it completely. He lets that guy get away with opening the door for him, but then he's not going to tolerate. He's not going to abide.
Yeah, didn't you already that know guy. That about
no,
him going in?
I didn't really. I'm being honest, Josh. I'm not totally trying to defend the movie here. I'm saying I thought that moment worked because at that point, it's already such a huge bridge for that character to cross to even walk into that support group room. So there are some doubts in my mind about, okay, maybe he's shifting. We've seen him at the library. We've seen him read things about the fact that this isn't strictly a quote-unquote gay disease. And yet, that doesn't matter. When he walks in and he's still confronted with that, I'm glad the movie had enough conviction to go, you know what, no, this guy's still really homophobic. He's still a bigot and he doesn't like these people. So I thought that actually worked. On the whole, yes, there's no doubt that as we get later in the film, and only people who have seen the movie will know what I'm talking about here, did I need as many shots of clowns as we get? Did I need as many references to the wildflower and the painting? Yes, I'm thinking of the rodeo clown. Did I need a scene with butterflies? Any scene with butterflies. Do I need a scene with butterflies in any movie ever? I probably don't, Josh. I could have done with fewer
You're
of those.
Anti-butterfly.
Yeah.
I didn't know that about you.
There you go. Send the hate mail in.
Silence of the Lambs?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
I knew
even,
you were going to go
even there.
It's
no
good.
No, you
know what? Damn it. You picked the one movie where it works, Josh. You had to do it. I totally flashed Silence of the Lambs as soon as I said that. But I still didn't feel like it was egregious. And I think a big reason why is that character's motivation. The focus that the film has ultimately is what keeps it from being, I think, too melodramatic or too obvious. I liked watching a character do something good for many, many people and be motivated not by a sense of altruism at all. In fact, just the opposite. He's motivated purely by greed. It's pure capitalism and it's spite. It's spite for the system and the hand he's been dealt. That's the bulk of the movie, Josh. That really is the bulk of the film. Now, near the end, some Norma Rae moments creep in. Those are all less effective for me. I do feel like maybe the movie had earned it at that point to have a few of those scenes.
Yeah, I mean, let's point out this is one of those movies where we get a scene of other characters applauding the main character for his actions. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we can act like this is a film that...
At the end.
It's still there and it's problematic because we're building up to that along the way.
We are
and
building
it's not
up to
in the
it.
Sense,
exactly.
It's not in a sense of character development. For me, it's focus... is a good word. I found this completely unfocused because, in a good thing, I think this was a very ambitious project, and I just don't think the film is able to take on and do well everything that it tries to do. This does not become the story of Ron Woodruff, either fighting his own prejudices or fighting this disease because it gets distracted by all of these side things. So it doesn't really earn that moment of applause for him because we get a sudden jump to his epiphanies. I don't know how many. I wish I had counted
way.
From the beginning the number of times we got an intertitle screen that said 3 months later or so many weeks later.
It's a device. You see it in a lot of films.
It's a device, but when it's used this often and what happens in between those scenes is a lot of stuff I wish we had seen on screen that would explain where we're suddenly at. And this doesn't just have to do with Ron's personal development. It has to do with his health. I mean, the day-to-day struggle of the disease that he faces with that we're really rooted in at the beginning of the film. I mean, I was uncomfortable in a good way with his sickness, and it was forcing you to deal with what he was dealing with. That's pretty much discarded after a while because the story is more interested in pursuing his fight.
And he does
for,
get healthier. Are you overlooking that part?
He does get healthier, but you almost feel like he's cured, where there is no struggle for him on a day-to-day basis. It's like he's found these vitamins.
I never forgot that he was
reason,
still suffering, ever.
Well, I did because the movie suddenly wants to be more about his business, which is great. And that's interesting, too, and worth pursuing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the choice that I'm having trouble with. It's the fact that they weren't able to pull off balancing all that because these other things get forgotten. And we get strange scenes that, again— could have been really good in maybe a longer or a more fully fleshed out movie. Jared Leto's character has a scene with his dad that should be really affecting, but because it
has
comes
a nice
out of nowhere,
it has a really
and
nice
it doesn't
beat in
really,
it.
We haven't seen it. The Leto character in general is a problem because he's used for broad comedy and then grand tragedy. And we get one or the
I
other
never
whenever
at
he
him,
appears.
Ever.
And that, oh, early on, it's very much it is his character being used as comic relief, which I think is a little troublesome in a picture that is also trying to promote some sort of social awareness. So, but I'm getting sidetracked by that. The main thing is that we're getting thrown so many different scenes and places that distract me from where I wish the movie had kept going so that it could just flesh out one of the things it was doing a little bit more.
Well, I'm personally grateful it didn't try to flesh out more the stuff about his prejudices. That's actually a strength of this film. I'm glad it focused more on the business than that, because I think those elements still come out as we see his character going after his goal. As we see the character trying to simply make some money and stay alive, all the other elements are sort of able to just glom onto that a little bit rather than it becoming this larger melodramatic thing. And I think that's actually why McConaughey is so good here as well. He doesn't play emotions. He doesn't play themes. He plays that character, a guy who clearly before his disease tended to get everything he wanted in life. And he's a character who I felt is charismatic in the same way as someone I just saw. Finally, I caught up with the movie The Spectacular Now. And there's some similarities between him and the Miles Teller character in that movie, Sutter Keeley, guys who are also troubled, have some substance issues, and do live just in the now and have sort of hedonistic lifestyles. It's really pretty astonishing watching this film and seeing McConaughey, how he approaches this character, that he just gets more and more determined to the point where even as he gets skinnier, and we do see him get healthier, as we said, but during that time that he's even getting more and more frail before he's discovered some of the medication and vitamins, the more frail he gets, the more intimidating and intense he gets. And I think that's a strength of McConaughey's performance.
Yeah, it's funny. We took this long to get to the performance because that's the main thing everyone is talking about. And I think the movie fails the performance for some of the reasons I've been talking about in not giving it the attention it deserves or the space it deserves or maybe the narrative threads that it deserves. Because McConaughey, man, he is really good here. I like how he brings that swagger you're talking about, and he never loses that. You know, he's got it at the start when he's sort of, like I said, this huckster who hangs out at the rodeo and places bets, and people are often after him, but he doesn't really care. He lives his own rebel life, and he still has that when he gets sick. And he has it. It's key to his business, right? And to making that business work when he starts negotiating deals with people, whether he's in Japan or he's all over the globe. But at the same time, the movie doesn't really concentrate enough on him with some of these sidetracks that it goes on, so that when a sudden scene like his trying to get back into the U.S. from Mexico and he's posing as a priest and he's lost his accent, all of a sudden it just has the feel of like a Mission Impossible movie. You know, he's pulled on a mask and I don't know where that came from. And
that's a guy with charm and charisma. That, I don't know.
Yeah,
it
yeah, but it didn't work for me because, again, it was kind of dropping in from something else, from somewhere else that I didn't really have a rooting for it in an earlier part of the performance.
Look, if you want to see a much better movie and a movie that does certainly get at the broader picture and see the full breadth of this crisis at the time this movie covers, watch How to Survive a Plague, a documentary that I did talk about last year. I think I maybe even had it in my Golden Brick nominees for last year. But I guess where we disagree is I didn't really feel like Dallas Buyers Club was too narrow, and that's not really your problem. Your problem is it trying to be too expansive. But I think in terms of comparing it to a movie like How to Survive a Plague, I don't think this film ever was so narrow that there was never any value there in terms of the drama or it being a semi-inspirational story of those things, of personal growth, of fighting the power, whatever it is. Again, not a film that is probably going to come anywhere near my top 10, Josh, but it certainly is a film that didn't annoy me as much as it did you. That's The Dallas Buyers Club. It's currently out in limited release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
We're not done with Matthew McConaughey just yet. Up next, we'll reveal the results of the film spotting poll, asking what has been his best performance. We'll also play a little Massacre Theater and jump right into our film spotting top five lists, actor transformations. Stay with us. quick interruption here, folks, to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project, whether it's for your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or other type of film project. You can choose from over a million high-quality stock video clips. There's also 2D animations and 3D motion graphics.
And one listener, Josh, who had a need for his next creative project and found a way to meet that need thanks to Shutterstock is Carl G. Martin. He's a recent donor who wrote into the show and told us this. Hey guys, I'm a filmmaker in Minneapolis, and I was recently putting together a short film to show off my Halloween costume. You know, like you do, Josh. One shot required a holographic tiger head to be placed over a woman's face.
Like
you do. One of those common dilemmas you run into making films, Carl says. Having no access to a real tiger, I guess, I decided to check out your sponsor, Shutterstock, and found a great clip to meet my needs. The Film Spotting discount code helped me keep the whole thing within budget. Keep up the good work, and if you're curious to check out the video I made, you can see it here. Love the show. We will link to that video that Carl produced over at our website, filmspotting.net, in the show notes. Shutterstock does source video clips from around the world and put them at your fingertips. Many of the contributors to Shutterstock are professional filmmakers, probably people like Carl. They offer flexible pricing. You can choose between individual clips or video packs, and you can download them in HD or save with standard definition or web formats.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. There's no credit card needed. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Save the video selections you like to your clip box. Then once you do decide to purchase, use offer code FILM1113 and new accounts will receive 25% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 25% off new accounts, use offer code FILM1113. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
Oh, hi, Tracy.
Who put you up to this?
What do you mean?
You just woke up this morning and suddenly decided to run for president?
No, I just thought that,
Thought what?
Well, I was talking to Mr. McAllister about my leg, and how I still want to do something for the school, and...
So Mr. McAllister asked you to run?
Well, I talked to him and everything, but he just said that he thought it would be a good idea, and how there's all different kinds of fruits, and, well, it's nothing against you, Tracy, I mean, you're the best. I just thought,
Okay, you're on, Mr. Popular.
Welcome back to Film Spotting, where we always remind you to pick flick. Reese Witherspoon there as Tracy Flick and Chris Klein as Paul Metzler in the Alexander Payne film Election, a film I know there are many fans of out there, and we're going to find out in the Film Spotting poll a little bit later in this segment whether or not it is in fact the best Alexander Payne film that's coming up. But first, time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater.
Actually, first, an apology possibly slash correction. Mm. I think they might be moths in Silence of the Lambs. So your anti-butterfly in movies, that
right.
Still stands, probably.
I think you're right. So butterflies still suck. I'm glad we decided that.
All right. Massacre Theater, we perform a scene. You get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this scene.
You're such a silly dodo, Richard. We're never getting off this island.
Thanks to you.
This is where we live. This is our home, now and forever.
No! I could never live here forever with just you. I don't even like you. You never used to laugh at me. You never used to have secrets you wouldn't tell me.
Well, you're not so perfect either, Mr. Richard Lestrange. I've seen you playing with it. And I'll tell your father if he ever gets here.
You! I hate you!
You almost hit me!
Take it back! Take back what you said!
I've seen it all. What happens after you've been doing it a long time?
Shut up! That isn't fair peeking. I don't peek on you.
That's a lie. You're always staring at my puppies.
That was Brooke Shields, not Shaggy from Scooby-Doo, which is what I unfortunately sounded like, alongside Christopher Atkins in The Blue Lagoon from 1980. It was written by Douglas Day Stewart, directed by Randall Kleiser. Do you know the other film Kleiser directed that involved sexuality and bright colors?
I hope it was better than The Blue Lagoon.
Grease. So,
well,
yeah, a little bit
then
better.
Then it definitely was.
A little bit better.
Wow. If you didn't hear last week's rendition of Massacre Theater, you were missing out on by far the most awkward, uncomfortable, disturbing scene ever. We heard from Sean McCardle in Canton, Ohio, who said the Massacre Theater scene is from the Blue Lagoon. And yes, Josh is starting to look like one of those Hoochie Coochie girls the cook kept in his drawer. Now go swim naked with the turtles, you two. There's another disturbing image for you.
Wouldn't be the first time. Dwayne A. Butler from Portland, Oregon. The obvious tie-in is that this is a coming-of-age sexual awakening movie. Plus, it also has the word blue in the title. Very clever, guys. Much props to Josh for the Brooke Shields imitation. Did you don prosthetic bushy eyebrows for the performance?
There was a transformation there.
Still
Josh's
wearing
part.
Them, Dwayne. Still wearing them.
This is how unclever we are. It didn't even occur to us that blue was in the title, just as it was in the title of our review last week. Blue is the warmest color.
I did notice that, Adam.
I didn't at all. It didn't register. At least two or three listeners did catch on, though. Finally, we hear from Kenny Montano. He's in Clinton, Utah. He says, "Sexual Awakening does not describe my experience with this week's Massacre Theater. Born after its release in 1980, I saw the Blue Lagoon on cable at far too young an age," which is the same for me as well, Kenny. "While I usually loved uncovering movies not knowing anything about a film before it aired, I was taken aback by the film's awkward sexuality that made me squirm in my seat. Rather than exploring burgeoning adolescence, Lagoon attempts to make being shipwrecked look fun, idyllic, and incestuously romantic rather than horrific and scary."
For Brooke Shields' sake, Kenny continues, "Swiss Family Robinson had more reality and complexity than this. Now, years later, you'd think I would be mature enough to handle the stilted dialogue presented by two thespians such as yourself. Alas, Josh's rendition of Emmeline has left me shocked and squirming yet again. For the effects of hormones on those shipwrecked, I'd rather see Lord of the Flies, or better still, The Tempest, 1,000 times over in a damp straitjacket than to hear Josh say, 'Puppies,' ever again."
We're all with you, Kenny. We're all with you. If you want to hear that scene, plus our review of Blue is the Warmest Color and our top five sexual awakening movies in the Blue Lagoon did not make the cut, you can get that show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. Josh, disappointed that more listeners didn't have that same experience I had, that Kenny had growing up, watching the Blue Lagoon for some reason over and over again when we were like 8 years old and never probably should have been seeing it. Not many entries, but enough to reach in and pick out a winner.
The winner is Kristen Roweth from San Rafael, California.
Congratulations, Kristen. Email feedback at filmspotting.net. We'll set you up with your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
"I think your dialogue is beautiful. I really do. I love it."
"Then why the hell don't you just stand still and say it instead of wandering all over the stage? You're supposed to be looking for your soul, not an ashtray."
No puppies in this week's Massacre Theater.
Thank goodness.
We promise. It is presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information is at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners will get the first 30 days free.
Man, this one took a long time. We had so many different ways to go trying to tie in with our top five this week, actor transformations. And Josh, I don't think we need to say anything more than that. We did finally settle on this scene. I'm going to start it off. You're going to give me the action.
All right. And action.
Hey, you see that Access Hollywood piece?
Yeah, I did.
It was like pistol whipping a blind kid. I mean, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. You are a huge star. But right now, you're like that kid on the playground. You know, the one who has lice and none of the other kids want to play with.
What do you mean?
I mean, we got to shave your head and get you back on the monkey bars, right?
What? What?
How'd the crying scene go?
Horrible. Methuselah starts crying, then he starts drooling and dribbling, and it wasn't even in the script.
And
scene.
Methuselah, well done, Josh, yeah, pulling that out.
I thought I was going to have trouble spitting that one out.
We did have some fun with the name there, not wanting to make the scene any more obvious than we think it is. If it was obvious to you and you know what film we just massacred, you can email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, November 18th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
"This is Chris Mangloss from Syracuse, New York, and I needed to call and leave a voicemail because there's not enough emoticons to deservingly tell you how much I hope that Killer Joe wins this poll question. Matthew McConaughey's performance there is really something to behold. Not a good movie to recommend to people without warning them first. But my second choice would probably be Mud, and though Matthew McConaughey is the best thing about that film, he's also the best thing about Killer Joe, and it's a far better film. So, hoping that wins. Thanks for another great season. Thanks, guys. Bye."
It was nice this week, Josh. We didn't have to play a clip from Killer Joe to help us transition into our poll results. Instead, we had that voicemail from Chris in Syracuse. We love getting voicemails here on the show, whether or not we make time to play them. We certainly do listen to them. And one quick note about our voicemails, just from a little audio quality standpoint, there's something funky about the voicemail system we use where, for whatever reason, the first 4 to 5 seconds of the voicemail come in a little bit watery and distorted. But after that, it's perfect. So if you do leave us a voicemail, the number is 312-264-0744. Just let it roll for about 4 or 5 seconds before
say
you
say their ABCs
get into it.
Or something, yeah. Like that. Get their, yeah, voice ready.
Go ahead, do your acting exercises, whatever you have to do. But let's get back to the content there of Chris's voicemail. He says Killer Joe is the better movie for him than Mud, both starring Matthew McConaughey. So that's why he went with Killer Joe in the poll. And the poll was simply, what's Matthew McConaughey's best performance? Not your favorite performance from the man, the myth, the legend, Matthew McConaughey, but what is his best performance? Your options were Wooderson from Dazed and Confused, Jake Brigance from A Time to Kill, Buddy Deeds from Lone Star, Dallas and Magic Mike, Mud from the movie Mud, or Joe Cooper from Killer Joe, the William Friedkin film that came out last year. Josh, how did it come out?
Jake Brigance is in last place with 5%. Then Buddy Deeds received 6% of the vote. Dallas from Magic Mike received 9%. And then up at the top here, we have Wooderson, Dazed and Confused. I would have thought he'd gotten more, 12% of the vote. Here are the top two, Killer Joe, Joe Cooper with 30%, but winning it, 38% goes to Mud.
That surprised me. Did it surprise you?
There's a lot of affection for Mud. I mean, it hasn't been a huge film in terms of box office, but you hear more.
A financial success.
Yeah, well, it is, but at a small level. Mm-hmm. And you hear more and more people just talking about it and saying how much they loved it. So, yeah, I could see that that won out the poll.
I guess I'm not totally surprised. We've certainly spent a lot of time here on the show talking about the director and writer, Jeff Nichols, and we did review that film both favorably. But at the same time, I did think that something like Wooderson and Dazed and Confused or even Killer Joe would probably win out, but there you go, Mud taking it with 38%. I think probably the Wooderson explanation is what we touched on last week, the fact that it's a supporting turn. Mm-hmm. He's just not in the movie as much as he is in the other two films where he's the title character. We heard from Zachary, who said, Killer Joe for sure. That performance was all around fantastic, but for me, proved that McConaughey had serious acting chops and that his rom-com period was just a period. Where in Mud, I still saw a little bit of that only on the screen for his pretty face feel. Killer Joe is a full-on Day-Lewis-esque transformation.
Wow.
Though he never chews nearly as much scenery as Daniel Day-Lewis does.
Kathy says, I have to defend his pole-trailing Jake Brigance role. I read the book years before seeing the movie, loved it, and thought he nailed it. I'm way out on a limb here, given the discerning film-spotting audience, but if you think about movies based on Grisham novels, Time to Kill is by far the best because of both McConaughey's and Samuel L. Jackson's excellent performances.
Yeah, I really didn't like A Time to Kill. I think McConaughey's pretty good in it, and it was actually the first time I saw him on screen as an actor, but it wasn't a film I enjoyed, so I guess
remember
I
him
discounted
being
it.
Exceptionally sweaty, right?
Yes.
Isn't that the very sweaty McConaughey?
He is very sweaty. Patrick Banks also wrote in, and notice here we have Zachary, Kathy, and Patrick. We don't know where they're from.
No
We'd
idea.
Love to be able to give that location. I don't know why. It just makes us feel good to hear where you're from. So if you do share a comment in our poll, we'd love for you to include your location. Patrick says, I pick Buddy Deeds because the myth of this character is well established before we even meet the character. If McConaughey's performance doesn't bring it, the myth cannot be maintained and the driving conflict of the film has no legs. My favorite film of its release year.
Oh, I like that reasoning.
Yeah. Absolutely. Good stuff there from Patrick and all of our commenters. We appreciate everyone who went to filmspotting.net and participated in the poll. We hope you'll go there this week as well to share your thoughts on Alexander Payne. His new film, Nebraska, is not opening this weekend. It's opening next weekend here in Chicago. It's out in limited release, and he has 5 movies so far, Josh, in his filmography. So pretty simple poll question. What do you think his best film is? Again, we're not asking your favorite, but which one do you think is the best?
Here are the titles. Citizen Ruth, Election, About Schmidt, Sideways, or The Descendants.
Is this a slam dunk for you? Do you know absolutely your answer?
This would be much easier to answer if I was able to quickly revisit a couple of these because it's very close among them. So, and I'm not going to have time to do that before next week. So I'll just say Sideways.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. Election is the one I really want to revisit. And About Schmidt, I know I underrated at the time. The question is, how much did I underrate it?
Hmm. About Schmidt is the one I probably have the least desire to go back and watch again.
Because
in fact,
feel so sure
it
of your...
does. No, I definitely don't feel sure. I think Sideways is the only film of his I've actually reviewed. So
Them
all, but it's the only one I've reviewed. It's the only one I really had any kind of take on whatsoever. I'd probably go with Election, but We want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. Also on our website, we are giving away some free passes, which we like to do from time to time here on the show whenever that opportunity arises. There is the new film coming out, Philomena. It stars Judi Dench, Dame Judi Dench, but also one of our favorite actors here on the show, Steve Coogan. And it's opening here in Chicago on Friday, November 27th. There's going to be an advanced screening of the movie here in Chicago on Monday, November 18th. And if you're a Steve Coogan fan, he will be in attendance at that screening and we'll do a Q&A afterwards. So you get a chance to be there in the theater with really one of the most charismatic actors you'll find. Funny, funny guy and a really talented guy as well. And you can be there for free. Just go to filmspotting.net and there's a link right there in the top stories. There's also a link at filmspotting.net for our apps, Josh. We do occasionally, more often than not, like to share some bonus content, which you can only get if you have the Film Spotting app. And by way of a teaser this week, Josh, I'd like you to read just the opening line here that came to us from Jenny. She's in Norwalk, Connecticut.
All right, let's see what Jenny has. Hey, guys, as always, Adam Kempinar was the voice of the people, and Josh Larson succeeded in upsetting me greatly, ...
So that's all you're getting. And the reason I like that so much, Josh, is because we can play a little game. We should do this every week. The game is, what movie is the listener talking about? Because there's about 57 we could pick.
We get these emails weekly is what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
I don't know. You like way too many obscure documentaries to ever be a man of the people.
No, sorry. Actually, you're right. I'm a little bit surprised. I mean, I used to have the moniker Art House Adam.
Yeah, the phrase doesn't really fit you.
Compared to you and some of your crazy responses to classic movies like the one Jenny's referring to there. Josh, you want to take a guess?
Oh, is this going back to Mockingbird?
No, it's going to, more recently, The Exorcist.
Oh,
so I guess there's not much.
I thought Michael Phillips was now taking all Exorcist responses because he likes it less than me.
Well, after you pinning him down and you guys just railing on the film and bonus content, I'm going to try to reclaim that a little bit in bonus content, at least share Jenny's thoughts.
Oh,
we
boy.
May also get to some thoughts. Finally, it's been so long now, but thoughts on another Sacred Cow discussion recently. That was the Stanley Kubrick film 2001. So that's in our bonus content, which you can get if you have the Film Spotting app for iPhone, Android, or Windows 8 phone. You can get everything you need to know about our apps at filmspotting.net.
Yeah. I'm beginning to think I might be a little sorry killing you. You like being alive. You also like to feel a man's hands all over you. Like it. Even if they're the hands of the man who killed your husband.
A little help from Henry Fonda there getting into this week's Film Spotting Top 5. He's playing very much against type in that scene, in that entire film, as Frank in Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in the West. Wonderful film from 1968. He is playing against his traditional character, how we think of Henry Fonda, but I don't think we would call it an actor transformation, at least not as we're defining it for this week's top five. Josh, do you want to define it a little more clearly for listeners?
I'll let Sam, our producer, I'll use his words because he was helpful in one of our emails. The phrase he used is where the actor as we know him or her disappears into the character. And I thought that was useful, especially in ranking physical transformations. So it's a little more helpful than who lost the most weight or gained the most weight.
Right.
It's how was that used to help them disappear into their character.
And I think physical is the key word.
Right,
we both
right.
focused on the physical. And the fact is Henry Fonda, beyond being a little bit older than we may remember him from previous films, is still very much looking like Henry Fonda. So that didn't apply. We'll note in the Pantheon, of course, Robert De Niro, Raging Bull, Jake LaMotta, that performance off limits because Raging Bull is one of those films that is put away in that hallowed film spotting ground. I'll also note that a performance like John Hurt in The Elephant Man, I think he's so wonderful, but it's one of those that's so driven by makeup, clearly, that I don't think of that character as a monster, though many do in the film regard him that way. We didn't go with monsters. We didn't go with people who are so caked up in makeup.
Creature
yeah,
effects.
Creatures.
I mean, maybe we'll do that sometime down the road.
Yeah, we didn't here, but this top five definitely inspired by the film we reviewed this week, Dallas Buyers Club, Matthew McConaughey, not looking much like himself there when he loses 45 to 50 pounds. Even Jared Leto as his co-star, another one who clearly lost a ton of weight and is wearing some makeup, playing a transgender character, doesn't look like the way we expect him to look. So transformations there, those were kind of our inspiration. What's your number five?
I'm going to go with a pick that when this was thrown out there as a possibility, our associate producer Candace Griffiths actually seemed a little skeptical about it. So hopefully I'll convince Candace that Renee Zellweger in Bridget Jones' Diary is deserving of being on this list. I actually do like the 2001 adaptation of the hugely popular Helen Fielding novel, the romantic comedy, that I always thought is unique in that it's in search of contentment rather than Prince Charming, even though it has
That's
a Prince Charming figure, for sure. And this is not, it's not necessarily a dramatic transformation, again, going back to the number of pounds that were lost. You look back and all the reports are, you know, that Zellweger added 20 pounds or something like that. But I did want to put it on this list, partly because everyone did act like that was such a transformation. And I really think that revealed a lot and still reveals a lot about our cultural attitudes toward women and weight. I mean, this would not count. No one would even talk about it in those terms if an actor gained, say, 15, 20 pounds, a male actor.
No, and that was
had
a lot of the buzz.
Up to 50,
going into
know?
The movie, not just when it came out, but going into the casting,
yes.
was what actress is going to be willing to play
big
Dowdy?
Enough,
yeah.
you know? And so I do think it's hugely significant that a female star, quote unquote, gained weight for a role. And here's the key, that was still meant to be attractive in a certain way. I mean, this is braver than maybe what Charlize Theron did for Monster, because there she was, the character was supposed to be ugly or off-putting. So there's not so much risk, if you want to use that
sure.
term there. And the thing is, Bridget is not movie starish at all. The character is endearing because she is disheveled, she is disorganized, and yes, she's probably slightly heavier than Hollywood standards. But there's also a poignancy here then that where real world reflects the film world, because the character has these legitimate concerns about her weight, or concerns she mm-hmm. thinks are legitimate. All right, so this list, I mean, how does it work for this list? It isn't a glamorous star just de-glamming, but a new star, when you think about where Zellweger was in her career, that's shedding herself of those Hollywood standards of glamour. And I really did completely forget, while you're watching this film, that here was one of the current reigning starlets after Jerry Maguire. You know, she was one of the it girls of that time. And it wasn't a heavier Renee Zellweger that we see on the screen, but it was Bridget Jones.
Look, are you and Cosmo in this together? I mean, you seem to go out of your way to try to make me feel like a complete idiot every time I see you. And you really needn't bother. I already feel like an idiot most of the time anyway. With or without a fireman's pole. That'll be my taxi. Good night.
Yeah, in Candace's defense, I think she just, for better or worse, rightly or wrongly, assumed that as two guys, Bridget Jones' Diary probably wasn't really our cup of tea. I think the audience for that film and for the book, probably safe to say, largely women, probably women around the same age as the character. As it turns out, we both kind of like that movie, and I even read the book. So
did you really?
She just guessed wrong.
Not ahead of time, I hope.
No, of course not.
Okay, good.
I waited until after. Actually, you know what, Josh? I used to not feel that way. I might have read it ahead of time. I'm going to follow your pick with, I think, probably an appropriate one, though it's a little bit of a counter to your choice. It's Cameron Diaz from Being John Malkovich, because you said that Zellweger wasn't someone who was just a glamorous star de-glamming. Well, that's mostly what I think Diaz is doing in this film. And the reason it's my number five is because it's the least glaring, the least blatant transformation, but it is a performance I really like. This is an actress who at that time was the bombshell from The Mask, who of course was one of the love interests, the attractive blonde from My Best Friend's Wedding, from There's Something About Mary. She really was, and you could argue still is, one of the most attractive female stars in Hollywood, with supermodel looks and of course that bright blonde hair. And then you see her on screen in Being John Malkovich, where she plays John Cusack's wife Lottie. And she's got that really bad frizzy perm. It's dark now. She's lost all the blonde. And as far as I can tell, is not wearing any makeup at all. But it's beyond that. It's not just the physical things. It's how she uses her face. She drops that big smile she has, those piercing eyes that you expect from Cameron Diaz, that smirk she makes when she's being funny or sarcastic. That, I mean, just saying that, I can immediately picture it in my mind. You don't get that at all in Being John Malkovich. It's much more dour. Her eyes are sunken in. She really does play that character as someone who is a little more defeated, certainly someone who's not brimming with confidence. And that's a real departure, because at that point, and I think largely still, Diaz plays characters who are always in command or seem really in control of their situation. So it was a departure in that sense, but I think it's largely driven by her physical transformation. She becomes kind of the most sympathetic character in the whole film, actually, and becomes the heart of that movie.
I've been going over and over my experience last night, Craig. It was amazing. I've decided that I'm a transsexual. I know, it's the craziest thing, Craig.
Nuts.
No, it's just that for the first time, everything just felt right. I've got to make sure. But if the feeling is still there, I'm going to talk to Dr. Feldman about sexual reassignment surgery.
This is absurd.
Yeah, what I like about that performance, too, is that it allows her to use her humor in a very different way, because she's a quite talented comedian,
right?
And you take that for granted, maybe,
but
because
kind of,
of
zany,
how she
kind
looks.
Of big,
yeah,
usually,
exactly. Yeah. And this is a quieter sort of humor that comes through. My number four is Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler, and at this point, you know, Rourke had already begun to physically transform himself in real life a little bit in disturbing ways. But director Darren Aronofsky, he really put that into the service of this great character, Randy the Ram Robinson, a washed up professional wrestler who's still chasing this sort of ghostly glory on the wrestling circuit, even though he's way past his prime. And it is a great performance, too. I mean, Rourke fully embodies this guy so that we do forget about that Hollywood circus freak that he'd begun to be thought of as. I mean, think of what he had to overcome to be bought as a legitimate real life character. And we do see the physicality of Randy here. It's so crucial to the film. It emphasizes one thing about this character, and that's his desperation. I mean, he tries to hide that in so many ways, but it's really the key to him in this film. I think about that scene where his stringy tendrils of hair, he gets them bleach blonde dyed so that he can kind of hang on to a little bit of that star glamour that he used to have. I think at one point, Randy describes himself as an old, broken down piece of meat. And that's what Rourke physically became for this part. So that counters to his public image, too. You know, all that other stuff he'd done was kind of to puff himself up or to make him look, I don't know what the desire was, younger, more powerful. And here, there's an element of that, but it's broken down, too, in The Wrestler.
Yeah, it's a great choice. Great performance in a very good movie. I don't know how much longer we're going to go on with our picks and have them sync up at all, but it turns out almost everything you said about Rourke and about his character in The Wrestler also applies to my number four, who is Mickey Rourke, though for an earlier film, Sin City.
Okay.
And one of the phrases that we used, I threw it out there, Sam threw it out there, to help guide us was, do you feel like the character is almost unrecognizable? And that's why this character, Marv, and Rourke's performance had to be on my list, because I didn't recognize him. I had no idea watching Sin City. I went in pretty blind, knowing very little about the film. And as I watched it, I wondered who that actor was. I couldn't put it together and didn't realize it until the credits. And of course, there is the style at play there a little bit, where it's black and white and it was shot all digitally against the green screen. So there's some effects work going on that maybe make it a little bit harder to discern who that actor is, but it's mainly physical and it's largely vocal as well. He's got that flat top haircut, which you aren't used to seeing Mickey Rourke with. There's probably some prosthetics involved, and he's really bulked up physically. He's obviously very strong and a very menacing figure, but that voice, the way he uses his low register in a way I'd never heard Rourke use before.
Goldie and the other six, where are they? What did you do to them?
You crazy goddamn broad. Just take a look at this mug. Would any of you dames let me get close enough to you to kill you? None of you would. But Goldie, she only did because she thought I could protect her. And I'll bet those cops didn't do a damn thing about those other girls, did they?
It's my favorite performance in the movie. It's my favorite character in the movie. He plays a guy in Marv who lives by a code, and he does some very bad things, but only to people who are worse than him, really. And I just had my eyes glued to Rourke every time he was on screen and holding on every word. It's kind of similar to going back to McConaughey, and we talked about his performance in Killer Joe, some of his best performance, where you really slow things down and everything's very deliberate and you force the audience to pay attention. You force the other characters in the movie to pay attention to every single word you say, and you see that care in the way Marv talks.
I'm glad you highlighted the vocal aspect of physicality, because, yeah, I think that is very important, underrated. And McConaughey, one of the things I liked about his performance in Dallas Buyers Club is how the voice is a part of that. When he gets weakened, it has the swagger I talked about, but it's also it's sallow, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can sense that weakness in it. So, yeah, the vocal aspect is a big part. All right, we need to pause a minute so Adam can shave his head, just like Demi Moore did in G.I. Jane. Then we'll be back with our final three picks for actor transformations. I'm really just in awe at your commitment to the show, Adam. Stay with us.
Hey folks, just wanted to jump in for a second to share our donations this week. Wanted to say thank you to our brand new donors, as well as acknowledge our $2 a month and $5 a month and even some $10 a month donors out there who really do keep us doing what we're doing. And Josh, our two new donors we're going to thank this week are appropriate for this show, considering we talked about Dallas Buyers Club, and you look at our new Silver Club donor. He's Mark from where?
He's Mark from Dallas. How about
that? He's in Dallas, and we also got a donation from Josh, and he's where in Texas?
Austin.
A lot of Film Spotting listeners down in Austin, and we, at some point, Josh, I'm vowing right now, are going to do a live show in Austin.
Wow. Just throw that out there.
I'm throwing it out there.
Is this the one in January or next July?
Maybe next July. We should do our 500th episode in Austin, Texas.
In July?
Yeah. Why not? Let's
do it. A little hot there then, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe a little hot down in Texas. And of course, if you aren't ready to donate to the show, but you still want to support us, it does help if you just go to iTunes and rate us. You can give us a star rating. And if you want, but you don't have to, write a few kind words about the show. We had been pushing people to go there and get us up to 1,000 reviews. We're now well over that, Josh. We're almost at 1,100. So our new push, 1,250.
Let's do it.
Help us get to 1,250. And I think, unless I'm mistaken, unless I saw it wrong, and I'm almost hesitating to even say this out loud, Josh, because then it's going to backslide and something will go wrong. I think now we have so many five-star reviews out of those 1,100 that our star rating is 5 stars.
That's brilliant.
So thank you so much to every Film Spotting listener.
And you probably just cursed it.
I probably did curse it. As soon as we go look after this taping, you know it's going to be back down to 4.5. But we'll take it for however long it lasted. Thanks again to everybody who has taken our call and gone over there to iTunes and rated us. We're going to continue the Texas theme here as we acknowledge our featured artist this week, the band Midlake, their new album. Unfortunately, Sam didn't tell us how to pronounce Antiphon or Antiphone, but you heard the title track and provider. Midlake hails from Denton, Texas. It's about 45 minutes north of Dallas. The band did go through a bit of a transformation itself, so we have a top five connection as well. Their new album is its first without the band's primary singer-songwriter for the first two albums, Tim Smith. They are currently on tour opening for Pearl Jam this weekend in Dallas and Oklahoma City, and then you can catch them in smaller clubs in St. Louis, Chicago, St. Paul, and points further west later this month and into December. If you want more information about Midlake, we have played them before here on the show. Very good band. You can get that at midlake.net. Finally, we'll close, as we always do, with an acknowledgement of one of our partners, Jeff Goldsmith, and his podcast, The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, and his iPad app for screenwriting, his screenwriting magazine there, Backstory. You can learn more at backstory.net, or just do a search in iTunes for The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, and you can get his interviews with mainly screenwriters, but also occasionally actors and directors. Try.
Hey, this is Mark Duplass, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
We're through the border. The boys are all singing pop tunes and all. But I'm just on the back of the bus looking out the window. We're going through them mountains. You know where Mount Errigal is and everything? It's a beautiful sight, Dom. Donegal has to be the most beautiful place in Ireland, I reckon.
You're listening to Film Spotting, and no, Adam, you are not the only one who can appreciate Michael Fassbender. That's who you heard there in Hunger, the Steve McQueen film, and he's my number three pick for actor physical transformations. Physicality was really one of the subject matters of this film, and Fassbender literally embodied that, so it just had to make the list for me. The movie chronicles the 1981 prison strikes that were staged by captive Irish Republicans, and it included a calculated fast in which 10 inmates actually sacrificed their lives. Now, McQueen spends a lot of time documenting the physical vulnerability of the prisoners. There's so much attention paid to their nakedness, their sores, mm-hmm. their wounds. Very difficult film to watch. Fassbender bears all of this and more to capture the resolute determination of Bobby Sands, who's the leader of the hunger strike. I did also want to put it on this list, though, because it's evidence that weight loss can only take you so far. And I think maybe this is a little bit of my hesitancy whenever I hear right away, oh, so-and-so lost so many pounds. Great. Let me see what they did then once the weight was lost. And Fassbender shows you, you know, you have to bring something else to the table. So here, it's really just one of the many tools at his disposal in this film, even though it is crucial. I think of the scene we just heard, that where there's barely edited and Sands is having the conversation with the visiting priest, a very lengthy scene.
24 minutes, I believe. Yeah.
Weight isn't a factor there at all.
No.
But still, it is a factor in this film, so Hunger is my number three pick.
Yeah, just a lowly honorable mention for me.
Oh,
I can't imagine
wow.
why. Because not only do I love Fassbender, I love that performance. That's the performance that made me fall in love with him, but maybe
I hope
just,
he doesn't find out about
maybe
this.
I just talk about him a little bit too much, so I held him off. But our picks are going to sync up a little bit again, because I'm going to see your Michael Fassbender and whatever weight he lost, and I'm going to try to beat it with my number three pick, Christian Bale, in the 2004 film The Machinist. He's an actor, Christian Bale, as I thought about this top five, Josh, who really strikes me as someone a little bit like Gary Oldman. And spoiler alert, Gary Oldman is not going to make either of our top fives, which is kind of a shame, because the whole point is, if you go back and look at his filmography, and I think Bale too, they are almost always transforming themselves. They mm-hmm. very rarely are playing whoever you think Christian Bale is. At this point, I don't even know who Gary Oldman or Christian Bale really are, because they're not actors like Mel Gibson or Harrison Ford or Bruce Willis, who are always Harrison Ford or Mel Gibson or Bruce Willis, but they really do seem to relish those roles where they can disappear into a character. And I don't know if with Bale, it's a case of just sometimes the costuming choices, he's in a period movie or his facial hair, whatever it is. Like I said, I don't know that you ever really get a sense of who he is away from the screen. Even going back to something like American Psycho, he's very much playing a character. He's wearing those suits a certain way. He's talking a certain way. He's bulked up physically. And then you go completely opposite that to his character Trevor Resnick in the Brad Anderson film from 2004, The Machinist. He lost 60 pounds to play a guy who is losing all that weight because he's plagued by insomnia. He's racked by guilt over an accident that he's involved in at work. And so you really see Bale, as we get halfway, three quarters of the way, and to the end of this film, just emaciated, and it really is a complete shell of himself. It's a movie I admit I badly need to revisit. I liked the movie. I didn't love it at the time I saw it on DVD, but I really was drawn to Bale's character and his disturbed, paranoid worldview. And one of the reasons you're so sucked into it, you're so consumed by it, is because you see how consumed he is by it physically. Bale had to sell that, and he did. And I'm just pulling this from Wikipedia, so who knows if it's completely accurate or not, but apparently he did lose 62 pounds. His eating to prepare for the role consisted of one cup of black unsweetened coffee and an apple or a can of tuna each day. That's how he lost 62 pounds. He actually wanted to lose 99 pounds, according to the story, but for various health reasons, the filmmakers would not let him do that. But that was his commitment. He was going to lose 99 pounds.
So this observation doesn't apply to The Machinist, because I actually haven't seen it. But I did seriously consider Bale, because you're right. He's known for going to these kind of lengths for roles. It seems to me, and Oldman is a good point of comparison, where Oldman does disappear into those characters. Bale, and this isn't to say that they're bad performances,
right,
but I'm a little bit away from appreciating them as much because it seems like the transformation is at the forefront with him, if that makes any sense.
I think you see that. I didn't feel that in The Machinist.
Okay, and that could very well be, but I think about it in The Fighter and some other films of his I've seen. Again, doesn't make them bad performances, but it comes... The transformation comes before the character.
No, I agree with you. Ultimately, I think that's probably fair. And yet at the same time, as I was going to agree with you and say, you're right, Gary Oldman disappears much more. He's one of those guys who loves to chew scenery as well.
Well, right.
So,
yeah. I mean, think about The Fifth Element, which I watched some clips for. Yeah, he definitely does. All right. My number two is Joaquin Phoenix in The Master. Paul Thomas Anderson's 2012 drama, your number one film of that year, correct? Also on my top 10 list. When we did review this film, I talked about the physicality of his performance as troubled World War II vet Freddie Quell. Everything from his face to his posture. Think about the way Philip Seymour Hoffman's character describes him at one point, skulking and sneaking. Even his hiccupy speech pattern, back to the vocal thing, is a part of this. And I would love to know, how did Phoenix gain all of those wrinkles? I mean, maybe it was makeup work or just the way he's screwing his face differently, but there's a marked difference. Even if you look at him in the trailer for Spike Jonze's Her, which is coming out, in which he's theoretically older than he was when he was in The Master, you know, he doesn't have those wrinkles. And they're key because one of the words I kept returning to for Freddie Quell was crumpled. I mean, this is a guy who's crumpled by his addictions, by his insecurities. He's just beaten down by the circumstances, self-inflicted and otherwise, of his own life. And Phoenix just offers a completely physical manifestation of a scarred and broken character, this sort of deeply damaged soul that can't make any sort of healthy human connection. So Master is my number two.
You shouldn't work in your condition.
No, I can work.
You're aberrated.
No, I'm not.
You know what that means?
No.
You've wandered from the proper path, haven't you? These problems you have?
I don't have any problems. I don't know what I told you, but if you have work for me to do, I can do it.
You seem so familiar to me.
Yeah.
Completely agree with you on your read of Freddie Quell and Phoenix's performance. We certainly talked about the performance and the movie a lot last year. It was my number one film of the year, as you noted. But for me, I guess that's one where he still looks so much like Joaquin Phoenix, not enough of a disappearance for me to probably qualify. It's one I didn't consider, but I think you make a really compelling case. Maybe a little bit more of an obvious transformation for my number two pick. If you go back to 1958, this actor probably wasn't quite the dashing cad anymore we saw in parts like Citizen Kane, The Lady from Shanghai, and many others. But Orson Welles as the police sergeant Hank Quinlan in his film noir, Touch of Evil, is my number two. And I got out easy on this one, Josh, because I didn't have to come up with anything insightful to say, because Tasha Robinson did the work for me. She talked to John Sayles recently over on the website The Dissolve. Tasha talked to him about, I think it was the 12 movies that influenced him the most, and Touch of Evil came up. This was just from this week, and we'll link to it in the show notes if you want to check out the feature. This is what John Sayles said about Orson Welles. That was a movie that, again, really impressed me with tone. There is a tone in that movie that's set right away, and it's just the way Orson Welles lights where he puts the camera. His entrance in the movie is, here's a guy who has gotten grossly fat. He's getting old. He looks like shit. And he puts the camera low and wide to emphasize that. There's no vanity there, though Welles was a very vain guy in many other ways. But for that character, he's like a monster coming out of that car and looming over the camera. He uses every trick in the book to set up this place that's, again, a very closed world of film noir, a place that's inescapable. Sayles, of course, nails it. When you think about Quinlan and Welles' performance, you can't help but think about those low-angle shots that emphasize how large he is. He really does consume the frame like a depraved monster. He's someone who you really get that feeling was once perhaps a good guy, was someone who valued things like morality and integrity and personal responsibility, and has now become completely depraved. And in some ways, he's actually what I think Coppola may have wanted in Kurtz. He's the figure that you really wanted to see in that jungle, leading that kind of lifestyle, the type of physicality that Brando wasn't willing to bring to it. He wasn't willing to be that lacking in his vanity, but Orson Welles was in his own film, and that's why Hank Quinlan and Orson Welles is my number two.
You've been cooking at this hour?
Just cleaning up.
Huh. Have you forgotten your old friend?
I told you we were closed.
I'm Hank Quinlan.
I didn't recognize you. You should lay out those candy bars.
It's either the candy or the hooch. I must say, I wish it was your chili I was getting fat on. Anyway, you're sure looking good.
You a mess, honey.
Yeah, I'm glad an older film made the list because I was looking for one of those. And I thought about this one, too, actually. Another Orson Welles performance that I thought about was in Mr. Arkadin. And he uses similar angles to portray himself sort of grotesquely. Also, wigs and beards going on there, too. So another transformation. Welles is definitely one of those early actors who was capable of that. All right, my number one, Tom Hardy in Bronson.
Yeah, before I forget, I did come into this world as Michael Peterson, but I'll go out with my fighting name, Charlie Bronson. Which is my alter ego.
This is sort of a transformation in retrospect because many of us didn't really know Hardy very well before this film from 2008, directors Nicholas Winding Refn. Yet if you take into account, even consider the bulked up characters in The Warrior and The Dark Knight Rises that he played since, you'd still be hard pressed to go back and recognize him in Bronson because he's huge in a completely different way. This is based on the life of Charles Bronson, who was in and out of Britain's prison system beginning in the early 1970s, often talked about as the country's most violent prisoner. Hardy almost becomes something animal in this film. I mean, we first see Bronson naked and pacing in a cell. He's bathed in this red light, and he's like a snarling tiger at some sort of sketchy traveling circus. The circus comes to mind because for much of the film, he also sports this crazy strongman mustache, and he's completely bald, too. It's quite a look. The thing about Bronson, or at least how he's depicted in this film, is that he was a showman. There are fantasy sequences of him performing a one-man show before an adoring audience. He sort of thrives on this mystique, this reputation, and definitely the violence that surrounds him. This is probably one of the most unnerving performances I've seen, and Hardy's physical transformation is a big part of that.
Yeah, he's so good in Bronson, as he is in many roles, and I think you nailed it why, for me, it's just an honorable mention is because, well, I kind of thought that's who Tom Hardy was after seeing Bronson. You really had no idea that there were
the shock
other
for me was
to
Inception.
Yeah.
To see, you know, to which may have been the first time, I'm not sure, may have been the first time I was familiar with him, and he stood out in that ensemble cast right away. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, who's this guy? Then I went back and saw images of Bronson. I'm like, really? That's the same guy?
My number one actor transformation was a movie I almost wrote off, Josh, because I felt like it didn't quite fit. I was going to rule out any multiple role performance, partly because it seemed like a little bit of a cheat, just that, of course, if someone is playing another character, they have to look distinctly different from the other character they're playing, unless that character is a twin, of course. But the other reason is we've done that top five before, multiple role performances, and I didn't want any crossover. But as it turns out, we did that top five before this movie came out, or at least before this movie played in theaters here, and we reviewed it. So I felt like I had to give it some praise, and this performance, I think you'll know why it's my number one. It's Denis Levant from Holy Motors, the film from last year. It was my number nine, I believe, of the year. I have to thank our listener Sebastian Nebel on Twitter for reminding me of Denis Levant. He plays, I think, nine different characters, and here are the names of those characters. The beggar, motion capture actor, Monsieur Merde, father, the accordionist, the killer, the killed, the dying, and the man in the foyer. So nine different performances, and he is distinctly different in each one of them.
There is a lot of makeup going on.
A lot
there,
of makeup.
Though.
There is, but there are some where there's less, certainly, where there's a one of those characters, and I don't even know which character it is. I'm sorry, I don't remember what the name would be, but the one where he really plays a creature, you know, a monster kind of living in the sewer system,
right,
whatever. That's very different from some of the other ones where he's just playing an older character or he's playing a certain type of businessman. I don't know that you ever see Denis Levant as you would see him if you just Googled the actor. He never plays just that guy in any of these roles, but it's not always as dramatic a change physically as some of the other roles are here in this movie. We talked about it last year, of course, and it's a film that I think is at once, I think I said, the most complicated and simple film once you just surrender yourself over to the fact that there isn't necessarily supposed to be a lot of narrative logic. It really
don't
is.
Don't try to figure it out.
Yeah, it's an exploration of, I think, the power of cinema, and I think it draws its strength appropriately from that lead performance and the way he does transform himself in front of our eyes into so many different characters. It is sometimes costuming, but it's also the physicality. It's just the way he reflects the varying psychological states of these characters. And somehow we're always dropped into these sequences just right in the middle of them. You don't get a whole lot of exposition. You're not really told what's going on. You're just following this character, and we do buy into it, and we play along, and we go along for that ride, I think largely because of Denis Levant's performance. So that's my number one from the movie Holy Motors, and those are our top five actor transformations. Josh, what about any honorable mentions for you?
The ones I also thought about, Hilary Swank in Boys Don't Cry, Daniel Day-Lewis in Lincoln, which it's mostly, he mostly would have made this list because of the way posture is involved, you know, but there's makeup there too, of course. Salma Hayek in Frida and Matt Damon in The Informant were a couple of others I thought about.
Yeah, I did consider Matt Damon for The Informant. I also thought of him for Courage Under Fire. Very small performance and an okay movie, but that was one of his first roles and he lost something like 50 pounds and you can actually see on screen that he looks physically ill. And I think that scene does stand out. So had to give some credit to Matt Damon. I did, of course, as we mentioned, consider Michael Fassbender for Hunger and Tom Hardy for Bronson, but also Robert Downey Jr. for Tropic Thunder. He almost made my top five. And of course, it seemed appropriate that it's an actor transforming into an actor transforming into someone. So I liked
it's
that
a brilliant
layer
performance.
There. Ed Norton in American History X, though largely he was really bulking up. Got to think about Tom Hanks in Castaway and also in Philadelphia. And I suppose you give some love to Johnny Depp for his Keith Richards-esque turn as Jack Sparrow in Pirates of the Caribbean. But the other one I'll mention real quick is actually a small role in this movie ultimately, but the actress Rose Byrne in the movie Get Him to the Greek. She plays Russell Brand's longtime love interest, longtime romantic partner, and she's a pop star herself. And look, Rose Byrne, very attractive woman, but I remember seeing that film and going, who is this actress? I had no idea until we got to the credits that it was her, somehow playing this really Britney Spears-like pop figure.
Had she given
somehow never saw that from her.
Any sort of comedic performance before that? I think that might have been part of it, too, at least for me.
Yeah. She did stand out. We look forward to your standout picks. Send us your top five actor transformations or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in wide release, The Best Man Holiday, directed by Malcolm D. Lee. It's his follow-up to 1999's The Best Man. Stars Terrence Howard, Taye Diggs, and Nia Long. And out in limited release, The Armstrong Lie. This is the new documentary from Alex Gibney about the rise and fall of Lance Armstrong. The Book Thief, this stars Jeffrey Rush and Emily Watson, set in World War II Nazi Germany. Charlie Countryman, out as well, starring Shia LaBeouf and Evan Rachel Wood. And Museum Hours is a new film out as well that we have heard a little bit of buzz about. That's Museum Hours. It was described at the Toronto Film Festival as, quote, a painterly rumination on how art influences and echoes contemporary society. It sounds like already my number one film of the year. I don't even need to see it. It's adored by a critic. Sam says here, Josh, that we love to hate and hate to love. I just love to love him. Callum Marsh, who wrote of Museum Hours, it's a film of such intelligence and originality that radical seems the only accurate word.
You may have to start hating to love him, though. Do you know that Callum does not like Dallas Buyers Club at all?
I don't love Dallas Buyers Club. It is true. I saw his review on Letterboxd, and he hated it even more than you did. Next week on the show, we'll discuss the new film from director Alexander Payne. It's called Nebraska, starring Bruce Dern. We'll also share one of our most trivial, but will probably end up being one of our most fun top fives ever, tying in with Nebraska, our top five movies with a place in their names.
How are we ever going to decide the parameters of this one?
Yeah, I love the ones that you don't have to think about. There aren't going to be a lot of emails going back and forth. A location in the title, it qualifies. All it has to be is a good film. We're also supposed to get, I hope we can finally get to the sixth and final film in our Korean auteurs marathon. It's the horror movie, or at least that's what we're told it is, A Tale of Two Sisters.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music comes from the new album from Midlake. You can find more information at midlake.net. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.